Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar sponsored by the Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, the Financial Services Practice Group, and the Litigation Practice Group for this litigation update concerning the case Texas Association of Money Services Businesses v. Bondi. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an assistant director with the Federalist Society's Practice Groups and Networks. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of the speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Joining us today, we have Nick Anthony, policy analyst with the Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives at the Cato Institute, and Rob Johnson, senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. If you have any questions for our speakers throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen, not the chat, so that we'll be able to access them once we get towards the close of our webinar. With that, I will turn things over to our speakers to start our expert discussion. Nick, I believe you're up first.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for joining us as well. We're here to talk about a case that has been unfolding over the past year, but maybe to kick things off, I want to take you back to 1970. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to drag you through each year since then, but I do want to hit some points over the past 55 years to really give you an understanding of where we are today and why, despite the prevailing notion that Americans have a Fourth Amendment protection, that does not extend to your bank accounts or really any of your usual financial transactions. So the core of this goes back to the Bank Secrecy Act. This was something that Congress enacted in 1970 after 2 years of congressional hearings and some past history before that. But the core of it was Congress was concerned. They were worried about tax evasion. They thought that this new thing called air travel meant Americans were finding out about these bank accounts in Switzerland, this privacy that they could get from it, that meant all this money was going to leave the country. And so after 2 years of hearing from largely government officials, Congress decided to unroll this new reporting regime. They were going to require that banks report at the time transactions of $10,000 in cash or more, and also keep a new set of records so that the government could come in and say, hey, we need to know what's going on. And this was something that quickly became challenged in the courts. It was something that made its way all the way to the Supreme Court and unfortunately gave rise to what we now commonly know as the third party doctrine. This idea that if you share information with your banker, you no longer have Fourth Amendment protections to that. The idea being that because you shared it, you somewhat gave release of that information. Frankly, I think most Americans do not share that view. If you ask them, do they expect privacy? They say, of course, I shred my documents. I close the door when I meet with a banker, or I talk in a hushed voice when I'm saying what my financials are. They even usually cover the ATM machine when they enter their PIN. So most Americans expect privacy, but the Supreme Court felt differently. And since then, over this course of 55 years, the battle has shifted. It went from a war on tax evasion to a war on drugs, a war on terror. And through those wars, it's expanded further and further. What started with currency transaction reports, those reports at $10,000, quickly shifted to suspicious activity reports. So now if bankers think you're doing something out of the norm, something that's a little strange, or maybe even they suspect criminal activity, then they have to report that as well. There's also reports for if you have an account overseas, if you're taking money across the border. All of these things have amassed into now what we typically refer to as the Bank Secrecy Act regime. And with that, today, now in 2025, 55 years later, we see about 27 million reports filed each year. 27 million reports. All of this costs banks about $60 billion in compliance in terms of having a team of Bank Secrecy Act officers, a team of lawyers making sure that everything is done by the book. And that's to say nothing of the fines that banks face when they mess up in this process. Maybe they miss something, or maybe they didn't report enough information. And all along the way, all of us have been losing any semblance of financial privacy, especially in the way that most Americans think exists today. When the Cato Institute surveyed the American public, most people thought it was completely unreasonable for a bank to share this information with the government, and most expected that the government should need a warrant. And that's really what brings us into today's conversation, because as if it wasn't enough to expand it over these decades, to expand it to the war on drugs and terror, government officials still want more. And that's really what we've seen with this case. But I'll turn it over to Rob to explain just how far this has come into people's lives now.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Nick. And so I think that background is really helpful because it kind of explains how we got into this case in the first place. So, you know, at the Institute for Justice, been litigating cases involving the Bank Secrecy Act for over a decade now. First got into this with a series of cases involving what's called structuring, where people were depositing money into their bank accounts in amounts under $10,000. And the government said, oh, you must be avoiding that $10,000 reporting requirement that Nick is talking about. And so then they would seize their entire bank account and try to take it using civil forfeiture. And we had a number of those cases. We ultimately, you know, kind of rolled back that particular practice and got Congress to actually change the law on forfeiture in that area, which was great. But I was looking at this and I was thinking, you know, why are people having to file these reports in the first place? Like, why is the government entitled to this information? And I started looking into this area of financial surveillance, and it's very troubling. And, you know, there's been a lot of information that's come out since then that's very troubling involving, you know, so for instance, under, you know, in the previous administration, right, there were accounts of the FinCEN, which is the agency that requires banks to conduct all this surveillance, directing banks to surveil for, you know, keywords in transactions like MAGA or Trump, you know, monitoring people's transactions for purchases of firearms, for purchases of travel to places where there were conservative coded rallies, things like that. And then there are also, you know, obviously people have probably heard about this issue of debanking, where banks are closing people's bank accounts because they're engaging in transactions that are over $10,000, or they're in other ways kind of triggering surveillance, and banks say, well, if you're, you know, if we have to file too many reports on you, we'd just rather not bank you at all. So, you know, all these kinds of issues. And really, we were looking for a way into this issue and a way to take this into the courts. And then along comes this order from FinCEN that just gave the perfect in on these issues. So what FinCEN did was they took that usual $10,000 reporting threshold and they lowered it to $200, so a reduction of 98%. But they did it only for businesses in 30 zip codes along the border. And the businesses that they targeted are what are called money services businesses. So these are businesses that provide things like check cashing, currency exchange, money transfers, like wire transfers, money orders, things like that, primarily for customers who don't have bank accounts. It's kind of like a alternative to the banking system for often, you know, lower income type people. And they said for those businesses, they have to report every single cash transaction over $200, which for many of these businesses is like over 90% of the transactions at their business. So, you know, we sort of went out and we started talking to these businesses. We, you know, hit the streets and knocked on people's doors and sent them letters. And, you know, as we talked to them, what we learned was that this was just an immensely burdensome thing for these businesses. So You know, for instance, this business that we represent in San Diego, they had never filed a currency transaction report. They'd never had a cash transaction over $10,000. But after this goes into effect, suddenly they have to file, you know, thousands of these reports. And FinCEN itself has done, you know, under the Paperwork Reduction Act, the FinCEN has to estimate how long does it take to file a report. And FinCEN's own estimate is about 20 minutes or over 20 minutes per report for small businesses that don't have, you know, the kind of automated software that like big businesses, big banks have. So, you know, at 20 minutes per report, this small business, which usually has one person working at a time, is suddenly facing like over 8 hours a day in paperwork. It is just a totally crushing compliance burden, completely unmanageable. And, you know, you talk to these businesses and they say, we're going to shut down. Like, if this actually goes into effect, we are going to have to shut down. Not only that, it's an order that doesn't really make sense. So what the government is saying, you know, their sort of rationale for this is, look, we want to target cartels that are laundering money. Sure, great. That sounds great. But the problem is what they've adopted as a measure to do that has nothing to do with, you know, targeting cartel money laundering. So like, you know, for instance, they have these businesses have to report every change in currency from dollars to pesos, pesos to dollars, or any other currency, you know, over $200. But like, are cartels laundering money by transferring money from pesos into dollars? Like, I'd never heard of such a thing, right? Also, they, you know, they have to report all these wire transfers over $200, which like, I guess you could kind of imagine that a cartel might like wire money into Mexico $200 at a time, maybe, although like that's a pretty low amount. But like if they did that, there's no reason they have to do it from a zip code near the border, right? Like cartels, these are multinational organizations that are, you know, the FinCEN's own administrative record says they're laundering funds using, you know, bank accounts and shell companies in China. You know, they're like purchasing fentanyl precursors from China. They're not like only at the border. So the idea that by targeting $200 cash transactions at the border, you're somehow going to capture cartel money laundering, it just doesn't really pass the smell test. And of course, it's all publicly announced where they're doing this. So like cartels can just move one zip code over or, you know, to a completely different state and avoid this surveillance requirement. So it's immensely burdensome. It doesn't make sense. And it's incredibly invasive. You know, the cartels are going to leave. It's not going to get any cartel information, but the ordinary innocent people are suddenly being swept up into this and are being, you know, targeted for government surveillance. So we brought two cases challenging this, one in Texas and in the Western District of Texas, and then another in the Southern District of California in San Diego. And in both cases, we obtained preliminary injunctions, and then those preliminary injunctions have now been appealed. So there's an appeal pending in the Fifth Circuit, where we had recently had oral argument. And there's also, and that's the case we're here to talk about today. That's the Texas Association case. But there's also a case in California, and argument in that case is scheduled in early February. So, you know, it's kind of proceeding on a dual track there. There's also a third case that we filed even later that is where we got a third preliminary injunction. And that case also has been appealed to the Fifth Circuit, but has been stayed pending the decision in the you know, First Fifth Circuit appeal. Why so many cases? You know, it just goes back to the issue of universal injunctions. You know, every time we've sued, we've gotten a preliminary injunction, but it's only for the particular businesses before the court. And so we've just kept suing and suing again. The claims that we're bringing, we have basically four claims. The first is a Fourth Amendment claim. And so the Fourth Amendment claim is both on behalf of the businesses, and also we have a claim on behalf of customers. So in these cases, we have both businesses as plaintiffs, but then we also have plaintiffs who use the services of these businesses. you know, the business claim is nice because we don't have to contend with the third party doctrine, which Nick mentioned, right? So even if the customer, you know, can't complain about their own privacy rights, the business still has privacy rights in its records. And so there we are distinguishing a Supreme Court case called California Bankers Association versus Schultz. And so this is one of the cases from the 70s that Nick mentioned that upheld the Bank Secrecy Act. And it specifically upheld the $10,000 reporting requirement. And, you know, I think one of the things that's been really interesting as we've dug into this and we've been arguing it is it's become obvious that this opinion in Schultz has just been massively overread by the government and maybe by other lawyers in the industry as well, that it's kind of been taken as like, oh, Schultz says the Bank Secrecy Act is constitutional. And so therefore you just can't challenge the Bank Secrecy Act. And that's not at all what Schultz says. It's a very narrow opinion. It's a 6-3 opinion with two justices concurring. So you have two justices who, you know, joined the majority, but also wrote separately and are essential to the outcome. The majority opinion itself is pretty narrow. It says that, you know, these kind of reporting requirements under the Fourth Amendment have to be reasonable. Sort of basic test is, you know, is it an unreasonable search? And it says, you know, the $10,000 reporting requirement is reasonable because it's targeted at abnormally large cash transactions. So, you know, $10,000 in the 1970s was the equivalent of like $70,000 today. So we're talking about transactions involving like briefcases full of cash, right? Like crazy amounts of cash. And the court said, yeah, like that seems unusual enough that we kind of get why that has to be reported. But they didn't say like all reporting is okay. They said like, this is a requirement that is targeted at a very specific type of transaction that has these kinds of red flags and is abnormal and limited, right? And it's confined in a way that's not going to impinge on people's privacy. So that I think is really important. And then you have the two justices who concur and they say, look, if anything more aggressive than this $10,000 limit, like that's going to raise very serious constitutional issues. So, you know, Schultz turns out to be a pretty limited decision. But then you also, you know, in terms of the third party doctrine, I think the third party doctrine has some kind of limitations to it that are not fully appreciated, which is that, so the case that establishes the third party doctrine is a case called Miller. And Miller didn't involve the $10,000 reports. It involved a government was subpoenaing copies of checks that were held by banks. And the petitioner in Miller said, you know, these subpoenas are invalid subpoenas, and trying to challenge the subpoenas. And the Supreme Court said that the bank customer couldn't challenge the subpoenas because the checks and other bank records were all things that had been voluntarily disclosed to the banks. And that was really like a key part of the decision, that the question of voluntary disclosure. And you don't have that when the government is actually mandating that a bank collect information from a customer that they wouldn't normally collect. And so the provision of this information is not voluntary, right? So usually like when if a bank is changing $200, a bank or a money service business, right, is changing $200 worth of currency, like they're not going to ask for a ton of, you know, biographical information from the customer. It's just like, okay, you give me $200, I'll give you $200 in a different currency. Like this is not we're not going to do like a financial colonoscopy on this. But now the government is saying for each of these transactions, you have to have all these reporting. And so you have to gather all these details about people. That's not voluntary. And so it doesn't fall within the third party doctrine. We got in the Western District of Texas, Judge Beery actually agreed with our Fourth Amendment claims and, or at least found a likelihood of success on their Fourth Amendment claims. And so that was part of the basis for entering the preliminary injunction. But then we also have other claims. So, and I'll go into those in a little less detail, but the first is a sort of arbitrary and capriciousness claim under the APA. And so basically that claim is that this just doesn't make sense. And, you know, part of it is this issue of evasion that the government can just, you know, the cartels could just go elsewhere, right? So like, why are we targeting particular zip codes? There's other reasons it doesn't make sense that kind of, if you like read their rationale, in the sort of, there's a memo that they wrote that, provides the justification for this, and you read it and it just doesn't make very much sense, but we don't need to go into all the sort of gory details of that. I'll just say that we had both judges agreed with us on those APA arbitrary and capriciousness claims. And then we also have a claim that's an ultra vires claim. And the ultra vires claim is basically, so FinCEN issued this under a statute that authorizes what are called geographic targeting orders. And a geographic targeting order is supposed to be an order. And the term order is basically a term of art under the Administrative Procedure Act, which means like a administrative action that is narrower than a rule, that it is targeted at a identified business, and that requires that identified business to do something. This is not an order, right? This basically says everybody who meets this regulatory definition within these 30 zip codes has to file these reports. That's a rule. It's not an order. So the statute authorizes orders. This is not an order. It's a rule. And so it's also ultra vires. And this is actually like, it kind of dovetails to some extent with the Fourth Amendment issues, because if the agency was limited to issuing true orders, they would have to make some sort of a factual finding that the particular business that was being targeted had some, there was some reason to think that that particular business should be targeted for this type of order, as opposed to just like collecting information from everybody, which wouldn't like solve all Fourth Amendment concerns. Like you could still see an order violating the Fourth Amendment, but it would at least like be tied to normal Fourth Amendment practice in a way where it's much more like a subpoena that, subpoenas can be unconstitutional, but like generally speaking, subpoenas are more defensible under the Fourth Amendment. So there's a kind of like constitutional avoidance aspect to that ultra vires claim. And then we just have a notice and comment claim that because this is a rule, it required notice and comment. It's basically the same argument, but just, it's a rule, not an order. So it required notice and comment. And the California court in the Southern District agreed with on the ultra vires claim. Judge Beery in the Western District didn't reach the Western District, the ultra vires claim, but both of those judges agreed with us on the notice and comment claim. So, we've won on multiple grounds. It's currently enjoined as to these particular businesses. And the litigation proceeds. I guess the last kind of update before, I'm going to turn it back to Nick in a minute, but the last kind of update is just, since then, the government has actually, so these orders are in place for a limited amount of time, then they naturally expire unless they are renewed. So what the government did is it renewed the order, but in renewing the order, it changed the threshold from $200 to $1,000, which, is a helpful change, but also still, it still raises a lot of privacy concerns. If $200 is a cart of groceries, $1,000 is a rent check, and we're still talking about pretty ordinary amounts of money. So the case has been going forward. The government, interestingly, agrees that it's not moot. And they say that the reason it's not moot is that they, essentially they say it's capable of repetition yet evading review. And actually both parties agree that the appeals should be decided considering the facts as they were at the time that preliminary injunctions were issued, meaning that the appellate decisions are still considering that $200 threshold, not the new $1,000 threshold. Was sort of an interesting little wrinkle there. But so with that said, I thought I'd turn it back to Nick, and maybe Nick, you could talk a little bit, kind of going back to the bigger picture, like how does this kind of fit into the bigger picture?
Well, yeah, pulling off of something you mentioned, and it's so important to remember here, is that the Supreme Court some of the justices did warn that if this system gets out of hand, if it starts expanding further, we're going to have some serious concerns on the table. And it feels a little weird to say this nowadays, but for folks who might not know, the 70s was when checks were really getting off the ground. That was the heyday of checks. And so right when this decision was being made, we were just stepping in as a country into using checks in mass, and it quickly exploded. And that's to say nothing of the digital age where we are now just being like fuel on the fire. And then also what Rob mentioned of that $10,000 amount being set in stone and not adjusting for inflation. I mean, today about 74%, give or take, of those 27 million reports I mentioned are for nothing more than $10,000 in cash was tripped. And that's not illegal activity. That's not suspicious activity. It's somebody pulling in their money from the farmer's market that day. That's some small business bringing in their revenue. And that's why one of the good things that came out of this was the court explicitly saying that it failed to see the logic of a large number of $10,000 reports being somehow indicative of $200 transactions being money laundering. And what's concerning here, though, and why I'm so glad that Rob and the Institute for Justice are challenging this, is that this will be a stepping stone to larger reporting. It's very easy to be on the East Coast and feel disconnected from any of this because it's all down at the border. It affects about originally about a million people living in these zip codes, but that's a small percentage of the country. So it's easy to say this is a war far from home. But at the same time, when we look at this history and we see how both through legislation, regulation, and frankly, even inflation, it's constantly being expanded to additional transactions, it could very easily be the case that this is expanded to all of us, to the rest of the country, either today or sometime in the near future. And it's so important to remember that because fundamentally our financial privacy is so deeply important. It reveals so much about us. When you look at your bank account statement, you can see it shows where you travel, what friends you have, what events you go to, what organizations you donate to, what religion you donate to. And that's information that we as individuals and as citizens should have control over. We should be able to say, who has access to that? When you go to your bank, you should be able to say, yes, I only want the bank to have access to that. I don't want it to be reported off to who knows where and reported off into a stack of 27 million other reports. And so it's really important that this is pushed back at. People were very upset under the Biden administration when there was a proposal to have surveillance at $600. And this is frankly just as egregious. Unfortunately, though, because it's a bit of a bittersweet thing. I'm both happy that at least it's limited to these zip codes, but I also see the bitter sense of that in that it's gone very underreported because it is a distant issue for much of the country. But again, when we see it framed within that, within the larger realm, we see that it's kind of a beta test in a sense. And as Rob mentioned, yes, I think it's a good thing to want to hold up the rule of law, to hold criminals accountable. But that's just not what we see here. With the larger Bank Secrecy Act, when those reports get filed, they largely just sit. It's been like pulling teeth to get any information from the government on this. But what limited information we have shows that out of the 27 million reports, there were only about 300 or so investigations started at the IRS in its criminal investigations division. That is nothing. For all the costs that I mentioned before, that there's about $60 billion in compliance filing all these reports. That's to say nothing of how it's violating people's fundamental privacy, but it's not catching criminals the way that it's supposed to. And as Rob mentioned again, that is a death sentence for a lot of businesses. One small business said that if this was put into effect, they would go from filing something like 9 reports at the $10,000 level each week to 50,000 reports at the $200 level. That is an impossible standard of compliance. And even though the government moved this up, which frankly, I see as being pretty wrong to do in the middle of these proceedings, but moved it up to $1,000, even then, it's going to be an impossible standard of compliance because a lot of these businesses affected are small businesses. So it's really just pushing groups that depend on them to the fringe, while the cartels and other organized crime, they're going to have no issue moving to a different zip code, a different state, sending it overseas. It's really not going to be a barrier. And that frankly explains why when the announcement came out from the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, from FinCEN, they really didn't justify it. It wasn't until the Institute for Justice got involved and started challenging in this that they tried to come up with reasons to say, oh yes, this makes sense. This is why we need to do this here. And yet what answers they came up with didn't quite make sense. And frankly, that tracks because when FinCEN came before Congress just a few months ago, FinCEN was asked, where are the numbers? How do we justify this? Congress ordered the agency in 2020 with the Anti-Money Laundering Act to report to Congress and say, here are all the justifications, all the criminals we're stopping, all of the successful convictions we've had, all of the money we've seized. None of that has been reported. We're now 5 years later, and those reports are nowhere to be found. And FinCEN quite clearly said, we don't know. We can't answer that. This entire regime was started with the idea of reports are needed to catch criminals, but yet we have no proof that that is taking place, at least on the basis that it needs to be to justify it. I will say FinCEN does have its law enforcement awards program, where it gives awards each year to about 6 groups for successfully using Bank Secrecy Act related reports. But whether it's 6 cases or 300 cases, that's not nearly enough to justify what's going on in the broader space or at the border or what might come next if this ends up becoming, again, a sort of beta test for the broader American public.
Yeah. So, and I want to pick up on something that Nick was just talking about, which is this question of, you know, expansion. And this is something we've seen time and again with financial surveillance type rules. So a big one is what's called the real estate, initially the real estate GTOs, and then it, you know, it's now the real estate rule. So basically, you know, about 10 years ago or so, FinCEN started requiring reports on large all cash real estate transactions. And they started this in just like New York, and I think it was Los Angeles. It was like 2 cities. And then, you know, every 6 months or so, they have to renew the GTO, and they would renew it and they would expand to include more cities, right? So the list of cities just kept growing and growing and growing until it was like 30 states, you know, like large chunk of the country. And then recently FinCEN just decided, hey, let's just, you know, get rid of the pretense that this is limited and we're just going to make it nationwide. And so they promulgated a rule that that requires this reporting nationwide. And, you know, that's kind of the dynamic that you it starts as a GTO in one place, it expands. So, you know, and I didn't mention this, but then when they lowered the threshold for this particular GTO from 1,000 to, when they raised the threshold from 200 to 1,000, they also expanded the geographic area where it applies. So, you know, before it was 30 zip codes, in some in Texas and some in California. Now it's additional zip codes, including some in Arizona, right? So the geographic scope is already expanding. And this is in their rationale. And, you know, when we said, hey, like the cartels are just going to move their transaction elsewhere, they said, okay, well, we'll just expand the rule to more places in the future. And like, that's the logic of this. It doesn't just stay limited to one part of the country. It's going to expand to more of the country, which is why it's so important to head it off, you know, before that can happen.
Very quickly, I just want to stress you're absolutely right, because going from 30 zip codes to 126 zip codes is nothing to blink at. That is a huge expansion. And again, to have that happen right in the middle of this being challenged is, at least in my eyes, a bit absurd. But as you said, it tracks with exactly what's going on and what has happened in the past. Very briefly, we talked about this earlier, where the Bank Secrecy Act has some even earlier history, where in 1945, the Treasury had become frustrated with stories of tax evasion and came up with the idea to start surveilling $10,000 transactions and did it by regulation. And it wasn't until 1970 that they ended up saying, well, we don't really like that because of the authorities we base this on, it's somewhat voluntary and we haven't had the compliance we want. So we want Congress to be making this actual statute, make this required by law and give us authority to expand it even further. So both the history near and far shows that this is the kind of testing ground that we see and frankly should expect.
Yeah, so this is like the central dynamic with this whole area, right? Is you start with surveillance of one piece of the financial system, and then the bad actors are just going to say, okay, well, we're just going to go to this other piece of the financial system. So then, well, then we got to expand the surveillance to that other piece. Well, okay, and then the bad actors just say, okay, then we're going to go somewhere else. And so, you know, you've seen this financial surveillance. It started out, it was banks and $10,000 transactions. Now, it's a whole host of other financial services companies and also like not financial services companies, right? Like it's recently it was expanded to antiquities dealers. There's talk of expanding it to art dealers. You know, there's investment advisors. Yeah, investment advisors, car dealerships, you know, the number of entities that are subject to these reporting requirements just keeps growing and growing and growing, because the reality is that if wherever you put the surveillance in effect, the bad actors are just going to leave. And it's the you know, regular people who are left behind who are being surveilled. And it means it's always going to be, the burden is going to fall on the regular people who are left behind, not on the bad actors who just go elsewhere. It's always going to be ineffective because the bad actors are always just going to move. The logic of it is it just has to keep expanding and expanding and expanding. And that's what we keep seeing. I want to be clear, right? Like there was to turn a little bit to some of the questions in the chat. There was a question in the chat about, you know, if they can move to another state, then they must not be so small. Maybe this isn't so burdensome. And I just want to be clear about this, right? The people who are the cartels can move their transactions to another state. The entities who have to file these reports, they're not moving, right? These are like small businesses that they're not going to go anywhere. They're stuck here complying with these regulations. It's the bad actors who can just hightail it somewhere else. To the extent that they were even transacting at these businesses in the first place, which, you know, I don't think is even established. I thought maybe we could sort of address some of the other questions in the chat as well. So there was one question, you know, asking, does Carpenter part of the Fourth Amendment argument here? And it is, you know, so Carpenter basically is a case involving the third party doctrine. And it was a case where the government was trying to access cell location data, but through a subpoena directed to the phone companies. And the Supreme Court said that kind of information is so revealing of a person's activities and whereabouts that the government really should need a warrant in order to access it. And it said that was true, notwithstanding that it was information that was possessed by a third party. So definitely we point to Carpenter, and, you know, I think the You know, only kind of limitation of that is that obviously Carpenter didn't overrule Miller, and Miller is specifically about financial transactions. So you do still have to contend with Miller. But like I was saying earlier, like, I think Miller is much more limited than people may realize, because it really was about voluntary information that had been voluntarily disclosed to the banks. And today, banks are required by law to get all kinds of information from their customers, not just banks, right? Also like the money service businesses that we're dealing with here and all kinds of other businesses that are subject to these restrictions. They have to affirmatively gather information from their customers that they wouldn't necessarily otherwise ask for. And, you know, that's not voluntary. And so the third party doctrine doesn't actually apply to that kind of requirement, which I think has gone almost unnoticed, as far as I can tell. So, you know, Carpenter, yes, but it's really, I think, maybe the more fruitful path here is to really pay attention to the limitations on Miller. The same question asked, if this is one of the implications of this could be to go after the suspicious activity reporting requirement under the Fourth Amendment. And I think, yes, definitely. You know, it doesn't have to go that way, right? So like if any, you know, it's not like if we win here, then SARs are definitely unconstitutional. You know, I think there's a universe where we win here and then courts say, yeah, but we're not going to touch the SAR requirement. But yeah, I mean, look, as far as I'm aware, nobody has ever challenged this requirement to file suspicious activity reports. And part of what I'd love to do in this whole area is to get, banks, financial services industry, people in these fields to start thinking about like, hey, like maybe there are in fact some constitutional limits on the kind of burdens that the government can put on us. And like, you know, for the last 50 years, it sort of feels like the industry has taken this as just like a matter of course, that like, of course, the government can require us to spy on our customers to whatever extent they choose, and we can't say anything about it. And I think part of what this case shows is that's just not true. And there are real limits here. And I think, the suspicious activity reporting requirement is immensely invasive, right? You have banks that are required to monitor everything that their customers do. And it's requiring banks to turn over information, without a warrant, without any probable cause. And it's immensely problematic. And I think that there's a real argument there, and I'd love to see someone bring it.
One quick thing to add on that note is the suspicious activity reports. We do have better data on that. And it's really important to stress that despite the name, suspicious activity reports are largely filed for very mundane reasons. The number one reason for filing a suspicious activity report is that someone got close to the $10,000 threshold for a currency transaction report, but they didn't cross it. So this gets back to what Rob was saying about structuring, the idea that someone is structuring their transactions specifically to evade that threshold. And so that's the number one reason why suspicious activity reports are filed today. And bringing it back into the $200 conversation, FinCEN also mentioned that in the geographical targeting order, specifically saying that financial institutions are encouraged to file SARs if they think somebody is avoiding the $200 transaction. And what that means in practice is that, yes, anything at $200 and above would get reported under this order, but then also 195, 190, 150, maybe even $100. If the institution has any concern that you're structuring, or maybe you came in and you did a $100 transaction and then you came back and said, oh, I need to do 100 more, that's going to get gobbled up in this as well. And so despite the name, more often than not, this is really mundane stuff where it's just people going about their economic lives. I mean, just to give you one more example, I not too long ago had to replace my water heater. And so paying for that couple thousand dollars was very abnormal and unusual for me. That was not something I usually do in my normal transactions. And so I'm sure for my bank that raised an eyebrow to be like, huh, usually he's not spending this much, especially not at one time. What's going on there? And just one other little note about SARs that make them so interesting is that the bank, though, can't tell me that they're concerned because it's confidential. It's both confidential in terms of what's in the suspicious activity report and also that it even exists. They cannot tell customers about them in any way, shape, or form. So again, this contributes to where many Americans think they have this sense of privacy because, somewhat ironically, this system is kept very private.
There was another question in the chat. It was asking, you know, just more about the effect of the, you know, what the status is with the preliminary injunction. So the status of this is after the government reissued the geographic targeting order, the government said that anybody who was subject to the initial preliminary injunctions would not be subject to the new geographic targeting order or the reissued one. So, you know, the entities that benefited from the initial preliminary injunction, they're still subject to the preliminary injunction. But then, you know, like I was saying, so this all goes to the, you know, there's been a huge debate about universal injunctions. And obviously there was a case at the Supreme Court about that while the preliminary injunctions were being litigated. And so, you know, the judges have been very nervous about issuing nationwide relief, even though these claims are brought under the APA, which, you know, the APA says that the remedy is supposed to be vacatur. And the Supreme Court, you know, in CASA said they were not questioning that. That issue wasn't before the Supreme Court. They didn't say anything to roll back, you know, the APA vacatur being the sort of standard relief. Nonetheless, judges are just, you know, I think on tenterhooks about nationwide relief. And so, you know, the injunction in California benefits all businesses, but only those in the Southern District of California. So it's broad relief, but it's broad within the Southern District of California. And then the Western District of Texas relief is only for the members of the Texas Association of Money Service Businesses, which is about 10 businesses. And then the injunction specifically states that other businesses can't join the association. So it's limited to those 10 businesses. And then the third injunction that I mentioned, it's we have two businesses that we represent in that third case. So, you know, again, there's tons of businesses out there that are still not subject to any injunction and that are having to comply with this. And it's immensely burdensome. And actually, you know, I know for a fact that businesses have gone out of business, have had to shut down locations. You know, this has had a major impact on these businesses, which is, you know, unfortunate. And it's why we're continuing to challenge this. Let's see. I guess the question was, has the agency stayed this as to these other entities? And the answer is no. And then, you know, I think that's sort of, they don't have to, right? Like legally, they have not been enjoined and it hasn't been vacated, on a sort of, so legally they can continue to enforce it against other companies. I think it's sort of like a policy matter. Like when you've had three separate courts say that your order is illegal, like maybe you should not continue to apply it to other businesses. But it is what it is.
I will say that was something that kind of caught my eye for a second when I was reading the latest order when they upped the cap to, or rather the threshold to $1,000, where they explicitly said, they being FinCEN, said in that order that where cases are currently pending, it does not apply, but that everyone else needs to go by the letter of the order. And yeah, that that is a bit of a strange thing to have these challenges on the table, to have serious concerns brought forth and confirmed by the court. And FinCEN effectively says, well, okay, we're going to move forward anyway.
Yeah. Obviously, there's a whole debate about universal injunctions, but the APA is very clear, and it says, if agency action violates the Administrative Procedure Act, it shall be set aside. And so, that's one of the issues that's being litigated on appeal, as well as, it's well understood that the proper remedy in an APA case is vacatur, that vacatur isn't party specific. Hopefully as this case moves forward, we'll get broader relief that, goes beyond just these particular parties and beyond the Southern District of California. There was a question. Yeah. Are any enforcement actions ongoing? Not that I'm aware of.
One question for you looking forward, where do you hope the case goes in these next steps? I know there's a lot of uncertainty on the table and pending dates that are quite a bit ahead, but what are you hoping to be the next steps?
Yeah, so, what our goal here is to get an appellate court to affirm the preliminary injunction decisions, hopefully both the 9th and the 5th. We get a decision that says that this is likely unconstitutional, and then we convert that into a final judgment that vacates the order and that provides relief across the board for all of these businesses. And that's kind of in the litigation. Beyond that, I think that this is part of a bigger effort. And the goal here ultimately is to put some limits on the Bank Secrecy Act. I think we had these two, like I've been saying, somewhat narrow decisions in the 1970s, Schultz and then Miller. And over time, the Supreme Court was very clear in those decisions that they were narrow decisions, especially Schultz. But I think even Miller has its limitations. And the court was very clear. It wasn't saying that everything goes. But over time, it's just kind of become accepted that the Bank Secrecy Act, Congress can do whatever it wants. FinCEN, the agency, can take broad delegations of power. And it's a whole nother sort of kettle of fish that, there's all kinds of non-delegation issues here where Congress basically says, you can require any reports from any business that you want if it will advance the statutory purpose of providing us with useful information, which, if that doesn't violate the non-delegation principle, I don't know what does,
Well, even the Treasury originally, if you pour through, which frankly, I don't recommend anyone does, it's an awful read. But if you pour through the transcripts of those hearings from 1968 to 1970, even the Treasury said, whoa, this is a lot of authority that you are giving the Treasury. Are you being Congress, are you sure you want to do this? And there was a lot of debate around that in terms of what the Treasury is able to do. And in the end, Congress basically said, you can do anything here. As long as you think it's right, go on ahead. To the point you mentioned earlier about how financial institutions are defined, frankly, it makes me laugh to see car dealerships and pawn shops on there, but my two favorites, or rather the two worst ones, are at the very end, where it says anyone the Treasury determines is exchanging value, or anyone the Treasury thinks might be helpful in this fight against crime. And frankly, that could be any one of us. It doesn't have to be a formal bank or other what we would think of a financial institution. And so you're absolutely right that reform is very much needed here. And it's good that people at the ground level are recognizing that this has gotten out of hand, that the courts are recognizing in this case that it's gotten out of hand, and even Congress is recognizing that reforms are needed.
Yeah, we had one more question in the chat that was, why hasn't the administration voluntarily vacated this pursuant to a deregulation policy? And, look, I can't speculate to that. I don't know. This to me is a regulation that doesn't make any sense. And I think part of maybe what's going on here is you got the word border in it. And so, there's some tendency to think, okay, this is about the border. I hope that I've explained that, at least from our perspective, this has very little to do with the border and is all about people's financial privacy. This isn't really about the border from the government's perspective. Again, cartels, we're talking about transnational organizations. They don't need to wire money from the border. Like, they can wire it from anywhere. This doesn't really make a lot of sense. So, if I was in the Trump administration and I looked at this, I'd think this is a ridiculous regulation that should be vacated. But, I don't know. I don't know. It is what it is. And, frankly, at this point, I'm happy to continue litigating it. So, I think this has been a great conversation because I think we've really gotten into a lot of the implications of this and the kind of broader issues. And to me, this should be absolutely a bipartisan issue, if not, an issue that folks on the right should be extremely concerned about and frankly are extremely concerned about, right? You hear a lot about, issues with debanking, a lot about issues with, again, during the Biden administration, there was a whole issue, and the House had a whole series of hearings about the weaponization of FinCEN to monitor transactions of folks on the right, which was a significant major issue. And, what I'd like to see is an agreement to maybe we could just roll this back and we should just stop, rather than okay, the one administration's going to use this tool to go after people for having MAGA in their transactions and for, attending conservative rallies. Then the next administration's going to, kind of repurpose it for this new, and maybe we could just take a step back and rather than, everybody sort of doing financial surveillance for their own pet hobby horse, let's just stop surveilling Americans' financial transactions and respect the right to financial privacy.
That is a very welcome change of pace, or that would be a very welcome change of pace, because you're exactly right. This is something that many people recognize is in their favor to reform when it seems that the other team has the power. And I think it's of the utmost importance that we remember that whoever is in power is just 4 years away from changing. So we need to have a longer term expectation on this. And looking at the past and how this has expanded pretty consistently and how it continues to seem to expand into the future, I think it's time that we've all said that this is enough and it needs a substantial reform, both from the courts and from Congress.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for joining today and for sharing your insights and expertise on this important issue. If our audience here today is interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org. Or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.